FM 90.9.
I am Champaign-Urbana Public Health District.
Provena Covenant.
Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 15, 2010, here in WILL AM 580. We've got a great show for you today. One of our favorite guests, a common guest here, a frequent guest, I should say, not common, Norman Solomon will be joining us for the full hour. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Google and Verizon announced an agreement on a joint policy framework this week that, if enacted, would kill net neutrality, the long-standing principle that keeps the Internet open and free from discrimination. Although Google claims it still favors an open Internet, the terms of the deal suggest otherwise. Free Press political advisor Joel Kelsey explains why this is much worse than a business deal between the two giants.
They're providing what they believe to be a framework for federal broadband policy to apply to the Internet ecosystem. And in this regard, it's much more dangerous. This is literally industry writing the rules for themselves.
The Google and Verizon proposal would allow broadband providers to offer various so-called managed services, which would have the effect of splitting the open Internet into two pipes. Kelsey worries that opening the door to such exclusive commercial arrangements could undermine the open Internet.
Those exclusive arrangements that are struck would increasingly make the Internet look much more like a cable system or cable operating to consumers, where each individual subscriber has to buy through different tiers of service at different price points in order to get to the content that they like. So in effect, if you don't narrowly define managed services, which the Google and Verizon deal does not, then you end up creating this kind of own private internet that's not the public internet, where all of the goods and services that drives demand on the current open internet is shifted into a pay-to-play system and makes it very hard for innovators and entrepreneurs to compete.
In this scenario, exclusive deals could restrict user choice and reduce competition for new and better services, like a new YouTube or Facebook cutting a deal with a single ISP. Users would be billed for each feature they want to access.
If you look at what the history of cable taught us, if you look at what the history of, in some regards, wireless service has taught us, it's that when the carriers are able to leverage their market power and monetize every little feature of the phone or service to extract more money from consumers, they absolutely will.
Only the future will tell what kind of business deals would be struck. And that, says Kelsey, is part of the problem with this deal.
You know, instead of playing with a half-baked idea and ill-defining it in federal statute, we should make sure that the FCC has the power to monitor and to intervene when necessary if managed services end up eating into the free and open Internet and impacting the investment incentives that have so far been such a recipe for success.
Google and Verizon's proposal, however, would strip the FCC of any authority over the Internet. Penalties for infractions would top out at $2 million, chump change for mega companies that rake in billions in profits each year.
the Google-Verizon deal completely undermines the authority of the FCC to make rules when it comes to the open Internet and actually directs them to defer to an independent, neutral body that is most likely comprised of industry players.
The proposal also explicitly bans net neutrality from wireless networks, allowing for everything from outright blocking of websites and applications to priority treatment for those who can pay the highest price. Kelsey says that this could be devastating for consumers.
It's all one internet. Consumers access the internet, direct their browsers to particular websites, and it shouldn't really matter whether they're connecting via a wireless internet connection or a wireline internet connection. They should be able to choose all of the products, services, and software that they want regardless of the technology that they use to connect to the internet. So the idea that consumers should face different opportunities, different restrictions, different monetary policies, have to pay more to download services, applications, to visit particular websites when they surf the internet wirelessly, to us, really impacts the future of mobile broadband.
For more information on net neutrality and the Google Verizon proposal, go to savetheinternet.com.
We're getting jacked, including myself. I can't believe you're taking people's wealth. You took TV, you're taking internet. I looked at the brother, said, damn, what's next?
They got Julius hemmed up what they're about to do, and I'm feeling internet as a title too. They want to profit real quick before they throw down, even though we need the net from town to town.
They got money to
Thanks
spend.
To the Media Action Grassroots down. Network for the remix.
There's no one around. If we could reclassify, let me contemplate. I glance in the cut, I see commission.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 15, 2010, here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today is someone who doesn't need much of an introduction to regular listeners to our program. Norman Solomon is a columnist and a writer and an author. Been on the show several times. His books include Made Love, Got War, and War Made Easy, about which documentary was made in 2007. He's the founder and president of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and for full disclosure, I'm a member of the board for that group. And he's one of the sharpest media critics and political observers in the United States today. Norman Solomon, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, thanks, Bob.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. There's a lot that's happened since we last had you on the show and since the last time you and I've spoken. Let's dive in and talk politics and media. And let's start, if we can, with a piece I know you wrote about. I looked at your website, Norman Solomon, on Press Secretary Robert Gibbs's attack this week on the quote-unquote professional left, and rather point and sharp attack upon the left. What was that all about, and what's your assessment of it?
Well, I think it was about this administration trying to play to the reliable media gallery, which loves what is called centrism. And I think we've seen that sort of response while a lot of independent and progressive sort of websites, those who identify even with being liberal or on the left, have really been very disturbed by what Gibbs said. And Gibbs basically labeling what he called the professional left, that they are just being unfair to the president. And this morning in the New York Times, we have a column by Maureen Dowd, who spent years attacking George W. Bush's administration in her syndicated column in the Times, I think quite effectively and often cleverly. She has a piece headlined this morning called No Love from the Lefties, and she goes after those she calls, quote, democratic extremes. She says, and I'm quoting here, Democrats are not prepared to go the whole way to appease their ideologues, unquote. And Bob, I'm really struck by this because what is this supposed extreme of criticism that people such as Maureen Dowd, a self-described liberal, I think, finds so unacceptable? What is it from people even like Howard Dean, who's no raving leftist, that is really getting the backup not only of the White House but also of so many pundits? And it's really those who have been critiquing and criticizing the war in Afghanistan, those who for more than a year have been saying that to allow the unemployment rate to rise is absolutely unacceptable, those who are saying that to treat Wall Street with kid gloves is also both wrong and politically suicidal for a Democratic administration. And in fact, if that sort of advice and advocacy from the left had been heeded by this White House, then the Democratic Party's poll numbers would not be tanking, I think, the way they are today, since so much of the discontent is about high unemployment, economic insecurity, and the war in Afghanistan.
Norman Solomon, you began your answer by talking about the Obama administration's sort of playing to the Washington, D.C. mainstream media and its sort of what it likes. And I think that was a very perceptive comment that obviously you don't see in the media since they don't cover themselves in that manner. But it strikes me that so much of the Obama worldview is defined by what is the conventional wisdom in Washington, that it creates a bubble almost for what's actually taking place in this country.
Yeah, a bubble extending along Pennsylvania Avenue and projected out from there into the media of the country at large. The great press critic George Seldes said that, in his words, the most sacred cow of the press is the press itself. You know, the eye and the retina can't really look behind itself, especially when it's uninclined and disinterested in doing so. And I think that is largely the story of the mass media, which when you focus and sort of look at all of it together, is, I think, centered almost, you know, this is almost a redundancy. It's centered in the center. But what is that? It's the center of power. It's the consolidation and holding of massive economic and therefore political power, whether it's in Wall Street or Pennsylvania Avenue. And so this president has been playing to what he perceives to be that center of political gravity. And so to speak, the corporate and media base that he perceives and tries to curry favor with is really quite a bit different from the electoral base that propelled him into office. And I think that's a contradiction that he is trying to skirt and kind of finesse through. But I don't think it's going to work come November, because Republicans are aroused, they're energized, they're enthusiastic, the polls tell us, about voting, whereas an appreciable part of the Democratic Party turnout in 2008 is turned off and likely to stay home.
Norman Solomon, our guest today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so feel free to call in with questions or comments. If you want to speak with our guest, Norman Solomon, the number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Norman Solomon, author, media critic, activist, author of the longstanding weekly column Media Beat for 18 years, I believe, and published in major daily U.S. newspapers. Norman, I think this event with Robert Gibbs going after the professional left, and I think pretty clearly what he meant by that was the blogosphere, liberal columnist, people like Krugman and Bob Herbert, sort of at the mainstream level, moving out to the liberal blogosphere and maybe the MSNBC nightly crowd of Maddow and Olbermann. What was striking about that, too, was just 2 weeks earlier, roughly, when the Fox News amplified a right-wing slur against Shirley Sherrod and then immediately fired her, almost without even considering any evidence. What does that tell us about the media culture in Washington and this administration?
Well, I think that the Obama administration has been playing to what it perceives as the proper function to triangulate by any other name, that while they try, especially as elections come along, to push off against Republican orthodoxy after often trying to accommodate to it on Capitol Hill, they also want to push off from and try to distinguish themselves from the left, or, you know, liberals, or whatever the negative buzzword of the moment happens to be. And so there are recurrences of what in the early part of the Clinton campaign became known as the sister soldier moment, where the candidate, or then the president later on, finds opportunities to tell off those on the left so that he can ingratiate himself as a would-be president or president, presumably with centrists. And there is a big constituency for that in the mass media, but I think a big problem is that leaving aside the content of the issues, and I think, you know, the disaster of this war in Afghanistan and the economic problem of joblessness in its own right needs to be dealt with forthrightly, of course. But as well, the politics of it is so self-destructive, because it's hard to believe there are many Republicans who are going to vote Democratic this November or 2 years later, because Obama and Gibbs and so forth out of the White House are going through this sort of demonstration trial, almost a media show trial against Shirley Sherrod or anybody else. It's sort of like what Jocelyn Elders, as the Surgeon General, experienced in the Clinton administration. Of course, mm-hmm. Lani Guinier, who was even a friend of President Clinton, but because she made some comments about structural institutional racism in this country, President Clinton dropped her like a hot potato from being in a slot for a high Justice Department position. And I think that's the exercise we're seeing again. Nor do I believe that centrists on the whole, if they consider themselves to be declined to state or independent voters or whatever, I don't think very many of them will be swayed by this flaying by Robert Gibbs of the so-called professional left. Those, I think, who are most likely to be affected are those who feel like they worked for, voted for, were enthusiastic to get Obama elected. They have progressive values. They don't like the war in Afghanistan. They don't like the White House sucking up to Wall Street while joblessness is going through the roof. And yet they're being dissed and told that they should just basically shut up and eat their peas and not criticize the president's centrist Gerald Ford-type policies. And a lot of people just aren't going to vote in response to that sort of attack.
Our guest, Norman Solomon, you've just been listening to our Media Matters. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 and the toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines for our first caller. Line 4, LaSalle County, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Thank you. I've been watching Fox News all morning, and they're ginning up, they're trying to gin up opposition to the president over this mosque, 3 blocks or 2.5 blocks from the old World Trade Center. And they're trying to make it out like President Obama is somehow involved with having disrespect for those who died. And at the same time, I heard President Obama say that they have a constitutional right to put up a religious institution on private property. And then he says he came out later, and Fox News to say, well, he's backtracking. And all he says was, I'm not commenting on the morality or whatever. I can't remember the direct quote. My question is, why won't the president just say flat out, appeal to his base and just say, look, everybody has a right to worship under the First Amendment. And this mosque is legal. And the people that are ginning up the controversy, they're even turning New York Democrats against these people at this mosque, who are harming no one. Now, why would a mosque be put 2-3 blocks away from the World Trade Center? Why would anybody suspect that they would be preaching terrorism? And I'm just outraged by this. And I wish the president would come out stronger in favor of the mosque. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Norman, I don't know if you saw this, but Glenn Greenwald, another writer we have frequently on the show as a guest, wrote a piece on his blog for Salon.com praising President Obama for his initial stance and the courage of it, and then noting how unusual that was. And Greenwald, I think, like yourself, has been very critical of many of President Obama's policies. What's your take?
Yeah, well, it's very much compared to what. I appreciate the caller's comments. I basically agree. The initial, I think the beat is on the word initial comments. The president seems to have a sort of a reflex to try to moderate or water down a strong principled position. He's been doing that a bit, but the reason that he's been doing that, I think, is related to why we can't depend on him to defend the principle, for instance, of habeas corpus, which he campaigned in 2008 saying he would uphold. That's, you talk about sacred ground, that's sacred constitutional ground that he won't stand and defend in any meaningful way. There's really a spectrum here on this issue of the mosque near 9/11 Ground Zero in Manhattan. You have Mayor Bloomberg taking a very principled, unequivocal stand, not only for sort of the generalities of the freedom of religion and so forth, but saying specifically there's no reason on earth why this place, this proposed religious center, including a mosque, shouldn't be zoned and built. You have President Obama, who's sort of indicated some sympathy with that position, but also been increasingly, since this storm broke over his initial comments the last couple of days, sort of trying to walk it back a little bit. And then you have the out-and-out xenophobes and sort of Onward Christian Soldiers jihadists like John Boehner, the minority leader in the House, who simply wants to define Americanism, whatever that is, as absolutely a 180 from Islam. And this is just, I mean, even George W. Bush didn't go there rhetorically. So I think we're seeing, and certainly Fox News loves to, as the caller said, gin this up and stoke this. This is xenophobia. This is, you know, ethnocentrism and jingoism to an extreme. It has a constituency in the mass media, Fox and so forth, some right-wing conservative commentators. Most are sort of splitting the difference and reporting both sides. But the underlying problem, I think, is the one that the great commentator Jim Hightower described as dead armadillos. He said, you know, there's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow stripes and dead armadillos. And President Obama seems to be auditioning to be a dead armadillo.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again on Media Matters today, Norman Solomon, who you've just been listening to. Let's go now to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. At the very beginning, you mentioned a column by Maureen Dowd. I noticed that the New York Times has had a whole bunch of editorials in recent months. They had a very long one by Gerson about a week ago, in which they say that Mr. Obama is his rhetoric is flat. He's professorial, cold, distant, and so on and so forth. He doesn't inspire any. You know, he doesn't get excited. He doesn't raise a fist. He doesn't kick a chair, and so on and so forth. This complaint seems to be made over and over again. And I think there's something to that. He doesn't have the hard edge, sardonic, comic way of a Roosevelt or a Truman. I mean, a Truman would say over and over again that good-for-nothing 80th Congress, and he made that stick. He made it stick. And Roosevelt, the same way. But I have another take on the Obama problem. I think it began right at the beginning when he let his... this idealism take over, and he said, oh, I'm going to work with these Republicans and work out of the center. Can you imagine Franklin Roosevelt saying that? Franklin Roosevelt said, every one of these Republicans hates me, and I relish their hatred. Furthermore, all of the New Deal came out of the brain trust in the White House. Roosevelt didn't send Social Security to Congress. He developed it in the White House, and then he sent it over and said, pass it. Get it done. If you send stuff to Congress and say, oh, you intelligent fellows, make up your mind about this, sausage making shouldn't be sent to the Congress. It should have been done in the White House. All of this stuff. But as a result, I'm afraid poor Obama is just dragging along because he just doesn't have the political flair to get it done.
Well, I think...
Thank you very much, caller, for calling in with your comment. Norman Solomon?
Yeah, I think the caller makes a lot of good points. I would, though, augment it by saying that there's a widely propagated media critique, which has some of those elements, that focuses on style without connecting the style to questions of substance. And you see that in Maureen Dowd's column today, where she says, I'm quoting here, surprisingly, he's in some ways an incoherent president. She goes on to say, he strains at being a populist, but his head is in the clouds. And some of that is just sort of like he doesn't have the right performance values. He doesn't have the right coaches. He doesn't present properly style in a stylistic manner. But I think that critique masks a much deeper question, which is, what is he fighting for? Why is he there in terms of policy? What are his core values that he's actually willing to fight for? And you find very little there. Roosevelt was fighting for something. He was fighting for jobless people, for instance, those who were suffering and out in the streets. He was fighting for a profound transformation in terms of Social Security, not as one person floating around, but because he had a relationship to social movements and vice versa, where there was a synergy, which goes back to this Gibbs comment. This is a 180 from what Roosevelt did. This was saying, I have this in 2010 is saying, I have no interest in bonding with social movements. They're there to support me. And it's a really, frankly, bass-ackward way for anybody who might consider himself to be a progressive in the White House to go about creating social change.
You know, Norman, I don't know if you saw Bob Herbert's column earlier this week in the New York Times, but he made the point that others have made, and I think the caller who just called would have been, was alluding to, which is that when President Obama came into office with what was really an enormous mandate and overwhelming political power in Washington, he had an opportunity to come in and really drive a progressive agenda on Wall Street, on the economy, on health care, and paint the Republicans who were really in deep trouble in the corner as sort of Hoover reactionaries who have no ideas except opposition, and really draw a sharp line between them. And instead, Herbert wrote, he opted really very much for the opposite, to sort of let these opponents up off the mat and dignify them and their ideas in a way that the voters had already repudiated. And I don't know if you agree with that, but it seems that it's a fairly depressing view because it doesn't suggest there's much of a chance for Obama to turn it around.
Yes, I do agree with that. And I think that in the economic realm, hugely, that has been played out to the point that you have someone like Paul Krugman, who you mentioned a little earlier, who is really no leftist. I mean, he's sort of Keynesian. He's a good economist. He doesn't just go for the ritual cant. And he has been increasingly alienated by the administration's refusal to look at basic job creation, at real adequate stimulus. And it's, I think, interesting to note that, again, Maureen Dowd's column today takes, I think, a somewhat oblique but noticeable shot at Krugman, where, and I'm quoting here again from Dowd's column today, speaking of Obama, she wrote, he has shepherded the biggest expansion of social programs since the Great Society and spearheaded the biggest spending program with the stimulus. But for the left and for some economists, it was not as big as it ought to have been. I mean, she's writing about it, and this is the tone of a lot of the punditocracy and the inside the Beltway Washington press corps for major outlets, as though this is some sort of minor tweaking that progressives and leftists and discontent liberals are somehow just ingrates. We want everything. We're not happy with a realistic approach to politics. And yet we have the official unemployment rate bumping up against 10%. We have the real unemployment rate probably closer to 20% by any human realistic measure. We have massive underemployment. We have so many houses underwater while Wall Street, thanks to this administration, is avowedly and clearly above water, and yet we have this media attitude as though somehow it's nitpicking to talk about the failure of this administration to have a genuine program for job creation.
Our guest, Norman Solomon. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here, if you'd like to call in to WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines once again. Now let's go to line two. Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes. Oh, Mr. Solomon, I'm getting so sick and tired. I'm a 74-year-old woman, and I'm getting sick and tired of you all constantly complaining about President Obama. He has done all he could do. He has done a fantastic job. Do you see what kind of Congress and what kind of Senate we have? The Republicans don't do nothing but turn against him and say, no, no, no. They want him to fail. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the businesses, holding back and things and not creating jobs. And you all just coming on the radio, I don't know what you're trying to do, but you all coming on the radio trying to make a name, and Lorraine Dow, whatever her name is, she ain't nothing anyway. All she does is write, and she ain't never been a president, and she don't know what it is. how to handle it. And another thing about the moth in New York. I am sick and tired of these people in New York complaining about the moth that moth been built in New York. That is just like a black church somewhere, and you say, hey, you can't build that black church there because. You can't build that Hindu building there because. You can't build that Jewish synagogue there because. I mean, the Muslims got a right to their religion, just like you and I. And I'm getting sick and tired of it. These people trying to change the Constitution, trying to change this and trying to change that because they don't like. And let me tell you one thing, man. Do you see many minorities out here fighting and things, and they in worse of shape than the white man? Worse of shape. But they struggling trying to make it.
Well,
I don't appreciate what you and the rest of you people are talking about. Just like President Obama hasn't done a thing. He has tried to work with the Congress. He has tried, and you got these Tea Party people here. You got these racist people here. Every day, I was seeing this racist crap. I come from Mississippi. I was seeing these monkey faces and all of this. I grew up with that, and I tolerate a lot of things.
Could I respond to you?
Yeah, let Norman Solomon respond. Thank you for the call very much. And, Norman, I think she expresses, you know, a strong viewpoint. And what's your take on it?
Well, I certainly agree with her last focus on the mosque in New York City, and it's totally wrong to try to prevent the building or operation of a house of worship. So I'm totally in accord with her. She mentioned that she's 74 years old. I'm 59. That's old enough to remember the mid-late 1960s when a Democrat in the White House in 1967 was appalled and furious when Martin Luther King Jr. spoke up against the Johnson administration's policy in Vietnam. It was Martin Luther King who went to Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967, and denounced in no uncertain terms a president who had been a champion of civil rights, who had shepherded through Capitol Hill the landmark civil rights law of 1964, and then, after Selma, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. How difficult it must have been in that context for Martin Luther King to speak up and denounce not only the war in Vietnam, but, as it happened, the policies of a Democrat in the White House who had been arguably the greatest civil rights president, so to speak, since Abraham Lincoln. And yet Martin Luther King did that. And so with due respect to the caller, I wonder if Martin Luther King had been on this program in 1967 and denounced the Democrat in the White House, Lyndon Johnson, whether she would have called up and said to Dr. King, you know, I'm sick and tired of you people speaking up and denouncing this president because he's doing good things.
On that note, let's go back to our phone lines. This is Media Matters and WILL. Our guest, Norman Solomon, who you've just been listening to, the journalist and author and activist. If you'd like to call in and speak with Norman Solomon, the number here, 333-9455, or toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Thank you. About the war, a reporter in Progressive Radio released the announcement that the aircraft carriers that are there standing by, along with the auxiliary ships to protect them, with all the planes on the aircraft carriers and the arsenal missiles and bombs and so forth, it's costing $7.5 trillion. Wow. Let alone the cost of all the maintenance of the armies and logistics and so forth.
I think that's probably B instead of a T. I don't think it's trillion, but it's probably billion.
Well, maybe, I don't know, but okay, but even so, the cost of the war is impacting all the other conditions that are occurring in this country. And if Eisenhower's caution about the military-industrial complex has any water substance to it, this is evident now in the detriment that it's costing all the other services that are being cut back that we stand for. And so recognizing the fact that the oil essentially meant for the military, they have a priority in the whole issue. But I just thought I'd offer a comment about the exorbitant cost of the war, not only in human life and other things, but then the resources and financing, having such a detriment.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Norman, I'm glad the caller raised that point, because we haven't really talked about Iraq or Afghanistan or the military in the first half of the show, and this is a beat you've covered with great awareness over the past decade in both Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran, the whole region. And I just wanted to get your take to follow up in that question on what you make of what's going on in both Iraq and Afghanistan right now, and how the Obama administration's handling this and how the press is covering it.
Well, I think the caller raises a crucial point about how the cost of these wars is or is not reported and dealt with in the politics and media of the United States. We know, according to the Pentagon, that for every U.S. soldier deployed in Afghanistan, it's an incredible cost of $1 million. That's $1 million per soldier per year of deployment. And you go back the envelope, you got 100,000 times a million, you come up with $100 billion a year just to keep those 100,000 troops there, not to mention, as the caller did, aircraft carriers and non-uniformed contractors. This is an increasing factor compared to Vietnam, much greater incidence of non-uniformed, made infamous by Blackwater in Iraq. Very much the case in Afghanistan, woefully underreported. There are a bit more non-uniformed Pentagon employees in Afghanistan than in uniform. So the actual number of, so to speak, deployed uniformed and ununiformed U.S. Representatives of the war effort in enabling and implementing the war effort in Afghanistan is closer to 250,000 rather than 100,000. That's the reality going on today. We're speaking here just hours after General David Petraeus launched his media war to support what is going on in terms of U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. General Petraeus appeared on Meet the Press, a very unusual appearance. He was in a sort of an informal uniform. He made the case that, quote, there are areas of progress in the Afghan war, which involved him threading the needle. Enough progress, he depicted, not to discourage continuation of the war, but not enough progress to justify any major withdrawals in the next year or two. I think that was clearly the agenda, and it was very notable to hear David Gregory, the host of Meet the Press, summing up at the end of the program today, where he basically was saying, gee, this is tough. There was sort of a nod to the Walter Cronkite famous broadcast in February 1968, in that David Gregory today used the word stalemate, erased it, and used that word as a real possibility in Afghanistan. And yet, David Gregory ended up saying that it just remained to be seen whether the U.S. had the stomach, and I'm quoting here, had the stomach to see this war out. So it was a sort of a modified war cry coming from the host of Meet the Press today.
What exactly, and I'm not asking this rhetorically, I'm asking this very sincerely, what is in the minds of Petraeus and Obama and the administration and the supporters of the war in both parties in Washington, what does victory look like in Afghanistan as opposed to what, what is it?
Well, I don't know what's in their mind, but I believe that a lot of the calculus has to do with kicking cans down the road past some election set points. And, of course, we've got the midterm elections in November, but then 2012. And it's been said that history may not repeat itself, but it tends to rhyme an awful lot. And Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam and Barack Obama in Afghanistan have a recurring symmetry and rhythm to them, because this is already an endgame towards 2012. And whereas the impetus for the invasion of Iraq came from Cheney and Bush primarily, and most accounts tell us the Pentagon top brass were, and I'm talking about the military top brass, not the, the war-crazed Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. But the military brass were not enthusiastic about invading Iraq, and they were dragged along by the president. Somewhat of a contrast with Vietnam and Afghanistan, where LBJ was terrified that the Joint Chiefs and top generals would say he was a wimp, he was not manly, he wasn't tough and strong against the communists. And today there's a good series of indications to tell us that President Obama has a very similar fear. And Stanley McChrystal really boxed him about a year ago by leaking out scenarios. And today we have Petraeus, and this is the beginning of a media jag all week, where Petraeus is really on a push to spin the need to stand firm in Afghanistan. And Obama really doesn't want to be caught flat-footed, I would say, similar to his accommodation to the right wing and the Republicans on a host of issues, civil liberties, health care, the economy, Wall Street. He's accommodating the right wing and the militaristic elements on the issue of Afghanistan.
Our guest, Norman Solomon. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to our phone lines. Let's now go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Solomon. I agree with your comments about military contractors, that I think that's something that's dramatically underreported in the media. I think it's an enormous change in U.S. military doctrine, and I don't think it's for the better. But I think that's a really important point. I think your question about what victory looks like in Afghanistan is a wonderful question. But I want to jump back to the a prior caller. And you talked about Martin Luther King's sort of criticism of LBJ and so on. And I have a point I want to make about that, and that is that LBJ lost, that he probably lost the 1968 primary in New Hampshire because he didn't have support of the left, and the consequence was we had Richard Nixon. And I don't think from the perspective of the liberals in the Democratic Party at the time that they would have preferred Nixon to LBJ. The second point is the institution, you know, notwithstanding sort of, particularly in the Senate, notwithstanding sort of popular support and what you called a massive electoral repudiation, you know, under the divided government system we have, you really need 60 votes in the Senate to govern. I guess that could change. But, you know, what is the progressive plan for Utah or Idaho or Mississippi or Alabama? I haven't heard anything along those lines. And to sort of succeed as a progressive campaign, I think that there needs to be a plan for those states. I'll hang up and listen to your answer on the radio.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Norman Solomon, why don't you field those?
Yeah, very, very interesting points and very minor parenthetical comment first. I will never be a Dr. Solomon in this lifetime anyway.
You're not even a B.A. Solomon, are you?
No, I'm a totally undocumented activist here. Yes, I think the caller makes some very interesting points. Technically, Lyndon Johnson, if I remember correctly, did not lose in New Hampshire, but it was so close and so shocking that Eugene McCarthy came so close in the numbers that it was, in effect, a huge defeat for Lyndon Johnson. Of course, he withdrew not much later on in that year. And, you know, hindsight being 2020, this is a box and a dilemma that the media system, in a sense, as well as more tangibly the electoral system, the so-called two-party system, really hems people in, where they end up in the general elections choosing essentially, and one would say this in light of history, in 1968, having the choice between Hubert H. Humphrey, a war criminal, and Richard Nixon, an aspiring and future war criminal. And in retrospect, and I've heard Daniel Ellsberg say this, it was a mistake in November of 1968 for progressives of the day not to go for Humphrey. I mean, I remember being cleared out of Lafayette Park in front of the White House the night before the 1968 presidential election, and we had buttons on that said, three strikes, you're out, referring to Nixon, Humphrey, and George Wallace, who was also running for president. And this is a huge dilemma, which maybe is directly related to the last point the caller made.
Before we get to that point, Norman, let me follow up on that first point, because it strikes me that the point he was making, which is if the liberals in the Democratic Party had just shut up and not voiced any opposition to the war in Vietnam, that LBJ would have won re-election, or Humphrey, had he gotten the nomination instead of LBJ, would have won in 68, and the liberals would be happier in the world. But it seems to me that, you know, if LBJ just hadn't done the war, he would have won the election, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I think there's good evidence that he would have run for re-election in 68 if he hadn't been so badly debilitated politically by the war that he insisted on pursuing, that, by the way, history tells us that Hubert Humphrey counseled against, and when he did that internally, LBJ ostracized him until he healed and became again a cheerleader for the war. We have this tremendous momentum that presidents gain through war, and for the populace, for the public, for people who are concerned to be silent, I believe, is never a good solution. It simply enables and perpetuates the worst of policy. That was true in 1968. It's true now. If you want to second guess how it was that Hubert Humphrey was not elected president in 1968, you can look at the fact that Lyndon Johnson knew that a bombing pause of North Vietnam would help Humphrey, and he delayed it so long that it wasn't coming sufficiently in time to defeat Nixon. This other point, which I think is related to the what you're zeroing in on this, Bob, is this last point about, well, you know, the president doesn't have 60 votes now in the Senate, and, you know, what's a president to do? When a president wants to fight for something, that makes an enormous difference. This president has fought for a corporate-friendly health care bill after the sausage was made on Capitol Hill, and he was willing to do it. And this president has not been willing to fight for much of anything that has a progressive agenda, including, by the way, the Employee Free Choice Act, which has been number one on the agenda of organized labor and working people. So to say that the president just can't do much, by the way, the House and the Senate are Democrat. There's a Democratic speaker who can control the flow of legislation. There's a Democratic majority leader in the Senate. So all of a sudden, the president can't do anything when he doesn't want to do anything. And when he does, he can order troops all around the world and do whatever the heck he wants.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have three callers who have been waiting patiently. I will do my very best to get to all three of you before the program ends. Our guest, of course, Norman Solomon. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's start with Champagne, line two. You're on the air.
I think a lot of my comments were already made by the previous person. I'm also old enough to remember 1968, and I worked for McCarthy, and I'm glad I did. But I sincerely hope that people will get out and work for progressive Democrats, because I feel that that lack of pragmatism in 1968 is probably some of the reasons why we're where we are today in terms of health care and some of the other things, which I think could have happened a hell of a lot sooner and a lot better if they'd taken place earlier. So that's my only comment. I think a lot of my comments really have been made by the previous people, and I do have that concern about, you know, progressives.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Norma Solomon, let's be clear on this. I mean, you, in your writings, your point isn't that people shouldn't vote necessarily for Democrats as a form of protest and get Republicans elected, but it's rather an observation that a lot of the people who voted Democratic just aren't going to do it because they're not enthusiastic, and they might have a Republican. They're more likely just not to vote.
Yeah, that's reality. I mean, the polls show that the effect of the White House policies and stance and tenor has been to discourage and depress voter turnout that is expectable according to the polls. It's ironic that this White House has depressed its own base against its own sort of electoral interest in that way. Why would they do that? Because the centrifugal force of corporatism is so strong, and represented by the appointment of people like Rahm Emanuel to be chief of staff, that it has empowered right-wing bogus xenophobic populism. The strength of the Tea Party, I believe, is somewhat attributable to the failure of the Democratic administration in the White House to really, really articulate a progressive populism. Instead, this administration is seen, and unfortunately somewhat accurately, as bonded closely with Wall Street, and that opens the door for right-wing populism and riding that wave from the Republican Party.
You know, I see it with students I teach and young people I'm around, people who voted for Obama in 2008 and were strong supporters, and they're just not enthusiastic now. They are not mobilized, and I don't think any of them or many of them will necessarily vote across the aisle and vote for Republicans. But most of them probably will vote, but I don't think any of them are going to go to the leafleting they did. They aren't going to do the hard work. They're not going to go the extra mile in this coming up campaign or in 2012 for that matter. And I think that's sort of where you see the effect.
Yeah, I think it's very ominous. And to some extent, I think this is, again, back to Robert Gibbs' comment and the Dowd column and what they represent. They're sort of blaming the messengers for the news. Progressives are pointing to what's happening in the populace at large. And certainly when we walk through the algorithm, yeah, after the primaries, you have to deal with, I think, a progressive responsibility to keep the right wing out of office. But you also have a responsibility to pursue political activity and media work that will, in fact, move policy in a progressive direction. And ironically, I'm afraid this administration, again, the dead armadillo in the middle of the road, is failing at either task.
Norman Solomon, I've got a couple callers I want to get to, but real quick, I want to get to the WikiLeaks controversy on the Afghanistan documents. What's your take on that? And, you know, WikiLeaks is taking a lot of criticism for exposing Americans and our paid agents in Afghanistan to possible violence as a result, and even some journalist groups have attacked them for that. What's your take?
Yeah, well, the war machinery is oiled by secrecy, and WikiLeaks, by disclosing and disgorging so many secret documents, blew a hole through some of that secrecy, which in part pervades the illusion that somehow on the ground these wars are not creating enormous suffering, much of which we don't ever hear about from officials or even from some of the best news media. When Admiral Mullen, the head of the Joint Chiefs, says that WikiLeaks has blood on its hands, I mean, you got to consider the source. I think that's what psychologists call projection. you know, that's not to say that there couldn't have been some better vetting and redacting, I guess would be the official term, but just there might have been names that could have been kept out of the WikiLeaks, and it's maybe a good reason to send some more money to WikiLeaks so they can beef up their staffing.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line 4, Champagne. You're on the air with Norman Solomon. Hello, line 4. I think line 4's patience has been lost. Let's go to our next call, line 3, Champagne. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hey, I'm glad I can hear you. The referring to a comment to the supposed two-party system that we have, I truly suspect that we have a one-party system with multiple candidates, all supported by the same general groups of people, namely military, business, and the whole list down the line. But why is it that sometimes we have the impression that the media is simply managing and making wealth of buying a candidate, and it doesn't matter which of any of them grow?
Yes. Well, there is what's been called the money primary or the media primary, where the winnowing goes on, and the candidates, particularly for Senate or president, they have to get through those primaries before a single vote is cast. So I think that is a reality. Media and politics, or the major media outlets and Capitol Hill, for instance, have a sort of mutual reference dynamic where the politicians in Congress or White House, they wake up, they look at the media, they say, oh, this is the reasonable bounds of discourse, And then the media look at the bounds of discourse adhered to by the politicians and say, oh, well, that's the reasonable bounds of discourse. And naturally enough, that excludes and has historically excluded all the major possibilities for progressive social change. And it's our responsibility, whether we're engaged in independent media efforts like this radio program, hundreds of others on the web, radio, TV around the country, to widen that boundary of discourse, or we'll be stuck in a negative spiral downward.
Let's go to our next caller who's been waiting patiently, Urbana, line one. You're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, first I just want to say I agree with the other caller, the previous caller. Also, I just wanted to quickly comment that you guys mentioned the firing of Shirley Sherrod earlier, and to me that just shows how much power the right-wing media really has, that they can get somebody fired by coming out with this falsified video. But anyway, the reason why I called was it seems like the radical right inspires the Republican Party. And, you know, you got the Tea Party protesters, and that the extreme right inspires them. But then on the extreme left, we're supposed to shut up and not say anything. I just wondered, you know, if you could comment on that kind of dynamic. Thanks.
Yeah,
thank you very much. You know, let me interject here. I might answer the caller's exact point. But a couple of days ago, I think Michael Moore was on Keith Olbermann's show, and one of them made the comment that the Republican Party fears its base and the Democratic Party hates its base.
Well, there's a lot to that, and it's echoed again by a lot of the sort of the aficionados of the Democratic Center in the news media. I think the caller's two points are somewhat related, that for the right wing to be successful, whether it's the firing of Sherrod or anything else, the stampede needs to be able to have successfully stampeded the president, which is what has happened repeatedly and happened with that firing. So to hang it on the right wing, I think, is half right. The other half is that a president who doesn't stand ground simply enables, which would go perhaps to another point. You know, if somebody is engaged in violence, we say, oh, they're engaged in violence. And if somebody else aids and abets it, if only by passively accepting it, we call that an enabler. And unfortunately, we have a president who, for whatever combination of reasons, is engaged in that process. And can you imagine, caller talked about FDR, can you imagine Franklin Delano Roosevelt backpedaling his way through his first term? What would have happened if he had refused to stand up and fight for what he ostensibly believed in?
You know, we've only got 30 seconds or so left, but let's say that what you're suggesting here were to take place, and let's say the Republicans were to win significant victories in this fall, and one of the current Republican leaders be elected president with Republican majorities in the House and Senate in 2012. What's that world look like?
That world looks like a disaster. It looks like much of the Bush years. And if anything, the Republican Party is farther right than it had been earlier on in the past decade. So I think it's a matter of people consolidating at the grassroots and seeing the dual mission of keeping the right wing out of power and developing the muscle at the grassroots for progressive policy change in government.
Our guest today has been Norman Solomon. Norman, I hear the band tuning up the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time from your weekend to join us today on Media Matters.
Oh, thank you, Bob. I enjoyed it.
All right, great. And I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Croha, the engineer, Melissa Trentz, for the producer, for arranging and working on today's program. I will be back with you in 167 hours. Everyone have a great summer week. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll have partly sunny skies today with a high of 88 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear and cooler with a low of 62. Sunny skies on Monday with a high of 85. Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 60. Tuesday, mostly sunny skies with a high of 85. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 62. This is Illinois Public.